Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Debate Night with Brody and Hunter. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or one of the audio platforms, or if you're joining us here live on YouTube. We really appreciate each and every one of you. We're testing yet again another new format. We'll explain
that
in a
second. My audio should be good, though. Audio should be good. Last week, I sounded like I was talking out of a freezer, but I think we should be solid now.
Yeah, he selected the wrong mic on Skype. Virtual debate night just brings on a whole new set of challenges.
Yeah.
But I think we've got it figured out. First off, though, I got to compliment that shirt. Listeners might not be seeing this. Actually, they're definitely not seeing this, but that is a loud shirt, and I'm here for it.
I call it my Easter egg polo. I thought it might have been fitting for the debate night tonight, you know, just kind of dress up a little bit. We'll see. I have a poll out on my Instagram right now. Early signs. People are on the fence. So we'll see how it works out. But talking about social media as well, if you haven't seen already, we have created a Twitter account for this podcast. It is at Debate Night Pod. So if you want, go over to Twitter. If you have that, follow us on Twitter, and we'll be posting notifications on, you know, upcoming episodes, potential topics, and posting maybe some clips and stuff on there as well.
Yeah, and if you are tuning in live and you want to be a part of the live call-in section, we're happy to be bringing that back. I'm going to walk you through the process really quick here. Basically, we're going to be doing it through Discord tonight, so we're going to be testing yet another one. Discord makes it a lot easier on our end. And there's also been some preconceived notions about Discord that I don't know where they were coming from, but Discord, our Discord server, it's discord.gg/foundationdiscgolf. It's completely free to join. It's a great place if you want to pop in, talk with a bunch of disc golf fans about everything going on in the disc golf world. There's all kinds of chats within there, grip locked, debate night chat, everything from hot takes to memes to live tournament chats. It's a great place to consume all things disc golf. But specifically for tonight's show, if you're tuning in live, go in there as soon as you join. If you're a new member, you do have to react within the roles channel with a check mark. And then if you scroll down under the podcast, you should see Debate Night Live, which Brody and I are in, and you should see Debate Night Green Room. If you have a topic that you want to bring up, go ahead and jump in the Debate Night Green Room. And what will happen is once we start the call-in section, I'll be randomly dragging some of you in. You'll be talking here live on the show to both Brody and myself. You can bring up your topic and we can debate with you that way. I think it's going to work really well if you're interested in doing so. And if you're listening on audio and you just want to be a part of a sick community, I think Discord is a little bit of an untapped potential there. There's a lot going on within the Discord that you can really find people who love disc golf and might also love the video games that you're into or all sorts of other stuff. But with that being said,
the gaming's starting to get a little hyped up over there. So I think it's an. I mean, we got other things on there. People talking UFC. People talking football. I know the LeBron Jordan debate gets brought up like once every week.
I try to pop in the basketball chat and just start that up like once a month.
Yeah. So it's an awesome place, especially like if you're just like bored and you just want to chat with some people instead of going on Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, where it can get out of hand. These are all people that support Foundation Disc Golf. And so you have some kind of unity there. But we're going to jump into the topics because honestly, we have live call-ins coming. So we need some time for that. And I've got a lot of stuff to say. The first one being, what's the situation with the cart, right? I just got a cart. Well, I've had it for quite some time. And there was always this stigma of like, oh, don't use a cart. Don't use a cart. And I was like, all right, I'll just carry my bag. I'll just carry it like a freaking beast. And just, okay, coming after COVID though, and like playing six holes and feeling like I want to keel over and die, I was like, I might have to try this cart thing out. I went and played a decently long course. It was about 10,000 plus feet. Played it back-to-back rounds and noticed a considerable difference in my energy level and just like my back soreness, if that's a thing. And I'm on the fence of whether I'd ever use it in a tournament. And my big thing too is I fly to pretty much all my tournaments. I can't really travel with a cart, but if it was an option, I'm on the fence right now. But when it comes to practice, you better believe I'm using a cart. What the heck? Why would I not?
So I've always been team anti-cart, 100%. I'm hardcore bag for one reason, and I just think carts look stupid. That's it. That's my only reason. I don't like the look of the cart. So maybe it's just the design of the cart currently.
Does it look like we're carrying like it's like that nerdy kid in school with the roller backpack?
We look like? Maybe. I mean, I never hated on Rolly Backpack Kid. The roller backpack.
That's worse than the cart.
Okay, looks wise maybe, but those kids were geniuses. That I was on a.
Oh,
we
yeah,
won't even get into
were
that.
Always, those were always the most
I always
popular
made
kids
friends
in
with
school.
Them. I always made friends with them because they were hilarious and they were the smartest kids. But regardless of that, there's just something about the look of it. I think it's just because no pros do it. Like, I think if I got into disc golf and the top pros were all carrying carts, I might feel different. You know what I mean?
You would jump on the cart wagon?
I might have, but it's too late now. It's too late. All the top pros could start. My opinion's already set in stone.
But it's like, why, if you're practicing, right, and your goal is to get as much efficient practice in having a cart will allow you to do that.
I
get
the practicality.
Why are you not doing it?
I get the benefit.
Why are you doing it?
I definitely see where it's easier just to pull something behind you. But there's also, you also have to understand the courses around me, which will soon be the courses around you.
Yeah.
Most of them are like you're hiking. And if you're bringing a cart, I'm pretty sure it's worse than if you're carrying
a
backpack.
It is. I would agree. It is cart. Like certain courses are very cart dependent. The local disc golf group that I'm in down here, when we go and play, when someone goes and plays a new course, one of the first questions always is it good for a cart?
Yeah.
So I completely understand that. It makes sense. If it is good for a cart though, like, and my whole thought too is like, if something comes out to where like the Segway, right? If there's some sort of Segway for disc golf, you better believe I'm using that. What the heck? I can play my, like, cause when I was practicing for golf, walking 18 holes would take a long time just to walk, not even to play, just to walk 18 holes takes a long time, but you can get around 18 holes in on a golf cart very quickly. So if you're trying to be efficient with your time, to me, it makes sense. So,
well, I think in a tournament,
I'm curious. I'm pro cart now.
In a tournament, just get a caddy.
Yeah, the only thing I don't like is trying to grab for whatever reason. Trying to grab. I mean, you saw this firsthand when you were my caddy.
Oh, trying
I
to
hate
get discs
grabbing
out.
Discs out. I hate that. I hate that trash.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I hate it.
Well, it's because all the bags currently on the market right now are designed to be pulled from the ground, so they don't have a lot of like. Give when you're reaching in, especially on the side. So once it's on someone's back, you got to take
it's
a few discs
over.
Out. Yeah, it's over. Game over with that.
All right, we're going to move on. The next thing I want to bring up is some stuff from – actually, we're going to go back a little bit. we're going to bring up some stuff from the previous podcast. I read some comments. Apparently, there have been a couple major league pitchers. One notable, I can't remember his name, but he was ambidextrous and would throw left-handed and right-handed. So I stand corrected there. Apologies. I still think it's an anomaly, and I don't think it's going to be something that you'll see in disc golf. Chocolate is candy. I have gone full circle. I'm back.
I am
on the chocolate is candy.
What changed there? That's news to me.
Cocoa?
Yeah.
Like the beans?
Yeah.
That's not candy.
Correct. That's what I was saying. Dark chocolate, like 90% cocoa.
They add milk. They do some stuff. They probably add some sugar.
Yeah, lots of sugar.
To make the chocolate. I am now on team candy, chocolate. Chocolate is candy.
That's what I was arguing last week.
That's where I'm at now.
All right.
Tootsie Rolls, however, not chocolate.
Yeah, no, that's chocolate flavored taffy. Yeah.
Yeah, more the taffy.
I was wrong there.
And then the last thing is, you were right. You called the Jake Paul fight. So I pretty much got dominated last week with all my takes.
He tweeted and said, most recent announcement, I'm now a retired boxer.
Was that just a joke?
What's going on there?
I think the way, if you look at the end of his fight against Woodley versus the end of his fight with everyone else, obviously, he didn't knock out Woodley.
Yeah.
And he took some big shots from Woodley. But his demeanor after winning, because that was the thing. In all those fights, he won. Mm-hmm. But his demeanor after winning this fight was completely different than his demeanor after winning those previous fights. I think he saw how much more difficult it is going against someone that has a little bit of striking knowledge, that has a little bit of power, and again, still someone that's undersized. Like Woodley in that fight was probably 12, 13 pounds lighter than Paul. Tommy Fury was on that card, and I think there was a reason
awful.
For it. He looked awful.
He looked so bad.
He looked really bad, but I don't know if Jake looked at that and goes, I want to take that fight. Because Tommy Fury, I believe, is the same weight class as Jake Paul.
That's just not a money fight.
It's not.
I'm not getting excited for that.
Well, you also probably don't know that he was on Love Island or whatever.
I heard that.
It was.
Yeah.
Okay. You know,
but it was
okay.
The UK version, right?
So he's pretty big. It's the same thing with like KSI.
Yeah.
There's might be a lot of people over in the States that don't really think or know who KSI is, but they're massive in Europe. My thing is, if he does end up kind of going that retiring route or like sitting back, not doing anything, I think the reason simply was this is what we talked about. He finally got to like a level of where someone could beat him. And like, if he goes and fights a Tommy Fury that no one has, like Fury hasn't beaten anyone good. If he goes and fights someone like Tommy Fury and loses.
Yeah. Then it's really bad.
Yeah, there's only like there's the people that he needs to fight to where if he loses, he still like comes out on top a little bit. I don't think he wants to fight those people.
Yeah.
So I think he's in a position now where it's like, okay, he's going up in difficulty. That's what he's been continually to do. But now if he goes up in difficulty again, I don't think he wants to.
One thing
that.
I thought was interesting.
It'll be
too,
interesting.
One thing I thought was interesting too was immediately after the fight when Woodley was asking for a rematch, and Jake Paul, you could tell, was not confident. It was almost like he felt like his win was a fluke, because he was like, at first he just immediately shut it down, and then eventually he came around to the like, if you get the tattoo, we'll do it type thing. But
yeah, I mean, Jake's a better boxer than Woodley. Yeah,
yeah,
Jake's a better boxer in the
but
sense
Woodley,
of the sport
I think
of boxing
has more
and scoring.
Knockout power.
Yes.
If Woodley would have called him one or two
Woodley,
more.
Jake hit Woodley with his best stuff.
Yeah.
Woodley got hit multiple times hard and kept coming forward, where the previous guys, Jake would hit him like that and they would drop. So, and you could see Jake was also completely gassed.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how it plays out.
Definitely interesting.
But moving back. moving back to disc golf, we're going to talk a little bit about the 2 meter rule real quick. Me and you, I believe, both agree on this. I think, like you said earlier, 99% of disc golfers probably agree on this. This might be a good call-in if you disagree with me and Hunter here. The 2 meter rule is potentially the worst rule. As of right now, the 2 meter rule is, I would say, the worst rule in the PDGA handbook. That might change once they allow discs to not discs to not be in the basket to still count as being in. But for right now, that the 2 meter rule is the worst rule.
It's got to be up there. I think what the main thing we're seeing here is it shows all the way back to our roots. Like, disc golf clearly was the grassroots of disc golf were from California, and a lot of the courses out there, it was a preventative measure, right? Like, the trees are lower. Players could have just thrown up and over, and so they're like, to prevent that, we just, if your disc is 2 meters up in the tree, you get a penalty stroke. What I don't like about it, and I'm assuming this is the same thing you don't like, is it's just the luck of the draw. It's not like clear OB where it's like, clearly if I mess up and throw my disc past that line, I'm out of bounds, I deserve a penalty stroke. This is like, I throw a perfectly good shot, it just sticks up in the tree, I get a penalty stroke, then you throw a perfectly good shot, it hits the same tree, falls down, and you're parked. Mm-hmm. And now I have a three, you have a two. That makes no sense.
I would say the majority of the time, too, that you're hitting trees is not on purpose.
Yeah.
There's very, very few holes, or hopefully less and less holes, where the best play is to just throw something up and try to hit it a tree and then plinko down. I think we're starting to see course design go away from that.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because that also takes out some of the luck.
If that's your course design, which that's what originally it was, nowadays that's just bad course design.
Yeah.
So if the 2 meter rule is needed, it's because of bad course design. It's my argument.
And I think also, the more luck that we can take out, right, the better. So same thing like around the greens. Like, if you want to take out the luck, you maybe don't want to have some like concrete or rocks or something like that around the greens, that if a disc lands on that, it skips a mile away from the basket. And if it lands just right next to it, you're good. That's why if you look at like bunkers, like on the preserve and stuff, like I'm fine with having bunkers on courses because they're large enough area to where you can see them and try to miss. If there's like just a little thing somewhere that you can't see, it's hard to like try to miss that you can't see. Mm-hmm. But in regards to the tree situation, like you said, two people could throw the same exact shot into a tree, one comes down, one doesn't. They both are penalized already from hitting a tree, but someone's now getting double penalized for just the luck that their disc didn't come down the tree.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a rule that I guess at some point it was definitely necessary for them to come up with it, but it's something that the sport's outgrown. It just doesn't make sense anymore.
Yes. All right. These right now, these topics actually are brought to us by our viewers. These are people that went into the Discord. We have a debate night suggestion spot in the podcast area, and you guys can drop topics in there. And a lot of these are actually being pulled from them. So here's another one. He goes, I think tasteful artificial obstacles are not only good for the sport, but going to be a big part of it in the future. Think Mando gates, think mozzarella sticks, etc. I'll let you go first.
Look, okay. Mozzarella sticks, I think, is the biggest one for me. Because what mozzarella sticks, if you're not familiar with, that is describing at USDGC, basically they wanted to make putting a little bit harder. So they put in wooden poles that were about 5 feet tall or so and staggered them on a side of the basket to make that the less favorable side, and then just wrapped it in like plastic ivory to make it look more aesthetic and quote-unquote natural. Idea, great idea, but it just doesn't look like part of the course. And to me, the farther we go down that line, same thing with certain mandos. Certain mandos, I think, just look awful. I think the farther we go away from stuff looking natural and looking like it belongs on the course, because like... if you look at a golf course, obviously the golf course, the sand bunkers and stuff like that weren't there. They weren't, they're not quote unquote natural, but they look natural. They look like they belong there. When you see mozzarella sticks and mandos and stuff like that, it just, to me, it starts edging towards.
But do the bunkers look like they belong there because golf has such a long tradition to where we've seen it so much that it just feels right? Because I'm assuming at a certain point, like someone had to decide like, hey, we need to put something in here to make it more difficult.
Well, another good example, sticking with USDGC, is hole 6 at USDGC. One of the basket placements is in a sand pit, right?
Mm, yeah, the beach hole.
That looks great to me. That looks fine.
Yeah.
Because sand is a part of nature. So I think it's more so like sticking within part of nature versus when you build stuff up, it just eventually it starts to look like we're playing mini golf or like I feel like it makes the sport look too much like a joke.
What if it was like a bush or a tree that they planted?
Perfect. I'm fine with that.
Okay. So you, but are you okay with, and we're talking USDGC because obviously it's coming up soon.
Mm-hmm.
Are you okay with like the triple mando hole with the bamboo?
See, so that's an interesting one because the
or the hay bales or like the hay bales on 17.
Hay bales I'm okay with because it's like an OB marking. It's the same thing to me as like signs on the Disc Golf Pro Tour. You know what I mean? And I like hay bales because again, it's nature. I think it would be different if that was like a white picket fence or something. I don't know. There's ways to make it look tasteful, but regardless, the hole 7, if it was implemented in a different course today, I wouldn't like it. But it's iconic now. So since it's been around for so long, it doesn't look gimmicky.
That's the tradition thing where you've seen it so much and it's such a big hole. Nate Sexton aced it and got SportsCenter. There's so much of that to where now you're just okay with it.
Yeah.
I think you're right in the sense of like there has to be that fine line of like what looks good and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think there's also different ways of making putting more difficult than just sticking some sticks in your way. I think the easiest way of making putting more difficult is the actual terrain around the basket.
Yeah.
So, Preserve actually had a lot of really good holes. And even Delaware, when we just were watching Delaware, there was a couple baskets that were placed in areas where if your disc was on the right-hand side, you would have basically a putt to where if you missed, you could have a roll away, or if you airballed it, it was just going down the hill. I think potentially that's probably a better way of going about it. Now that is going to require moving dirt, and I don't know how many disc golf courses have done that. That is something that golf courses do every single one. Every single big golf course moves dirt. And so it'd be cool to see like, hey, this is just a basket in the middle of the field. How do we make this hole harder? Yeah. And you get someone to come in there and like, okay, well, we're just going to make a cliff on the left side. So that way people have to throw to the right side of the basket and then they have to decide whether or not they want to run the putt. That could be real interesting. But again, I think a lot of that's going to take time and a lot of that's going to take money coming in so that, you know, these people that are making these courses actually can do things like that.
Yeah, and a lot of it too is, I mean, all that has to be on private courses. There's so many courses that
you can't do that in public.
I do think that makes the most sense of bringing dirt in, changing the terrain. Because I think the mozzarella sticks, I don't like the idea of, just because I don't like the idea of there being something physical like that so close to the basket. Because, I mean, some of the holes, they're like within 10 feet. But if that was a hill or like a bump that discouraged you from landing there or something like that, or made it harder for your disc to stick there, I'd feel a lot different about it. And I think it accomplishes the same thing. So like I said, I think that's a great idea, the mozzarella sticks and what they're there for and the course design idea behind it. I think that was a great idea. I just think the way it was executed, I just think it makes our sport look too gimmicky and childish kind of. Realistically, when you said the ace on SportsCenter for hole 7, the bamboo hole, there's a chance that did the same thing to a non-disc golf audience seeing that hole for the first time. There's a chance that made them think the exact same thing. I don't know. Mm. I'm just, to me, that hole doesn't seem weird to me because when I see it, I think of some, I mean, Ken Climo, I think it was, aced it before it was even a Mando, throwing a Spikeizer up and over it and stuff.
I think it's also big enough.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of a decent structure to where if it was like, if it was like Mulligan's hole 8, I think, or whatever, that like little dinky, like triple Mando that they had, and they just had like a little ribbon across the top.
Yeah. It sagged down.
Yeah. Like something like that probably looks not as put together. So I think that might have something to do with it.
Yeah. I think a lot of it too, because when I was speaking about it and you said the hay bales and I mentioned like a white picket fence, I don't feel like I would hate a picket fence either. I think a lot of it is just what looks good with the course.
Yes, the terrain of the course. Something
just matching it to the feel of the event, the terrain of the the course. Because there's some courses where a white picket fence stands out like a sore thumb and would look awful. But at USDGC, I don't know that would look that bad. Now that I'm thinking about
especially
it.
Especially if it was like consistent around the course.
Yeah.
If it was kind of its style. And
so
I think it's more
the course designer has to think about the looks of the course and the optics before putting in these artificial things and making the course all look cohesive and look together. Then I might not hate him as much as I thought I did.
Gotcha. All right, last topic before we open it up to the calls. Should different plastics have different flight numbers in discs? And also, should all flight numbers be made by the PDGA? This is a good one. And for those that are listening that might be newer to disc golf, flight numbers essentially is a way of giving you a rough estimate on the flight that you should see from that disc thrown properly and at the right speed. So this is where it gets obviously really tricky because it's I'm trying to think if it's really anything like, I mean, maybe bowling might have some statistics when you buy a bowling ball of like, this one's going to cut more with the spin, or
a lot of that I think depends on the wax on the lane for bowling.
But there are different, like, people will use a different ball to throw for like a spare versus a ball to throw for a strike at the beginning. So I think there are different characteristics in bowling balls.
Didn't know that.
But I'm trying to think of another sport where there's characteristics like this, because you would never say in golf or tennis or hockey or anything like, oh, if you use this stick, if you use this racket, if you use this club, it's the ball flight or the, you know, puck flight or whatever it is going to look like this, because so much of it is so many other factors. So for those that are listening, you've got basically most companies have four numbers when it comes to flight numbers. You've got your speed. You've got your, is it turn and then glide?
It's speed, glide, and then the high speed turn and the low speed fade.
Speed, glide, high speed turn, low speed fade. And again, these are very specific to how the disc is thrown. But this question's asking the first part, which I think let's actually tackle that second. Let's go with the PDGA first.
Okay.
Right, as of right now, flight numbers are
fictional.
They're decided by the manufacturer. So you are the owner for Hunter Discs. I'm the owner of Dark Horse Discs. I come out with a disc that's the same exact disc as yours. We just somehow made exactly the same disc without knowing it. Our flight numbers could be completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a big part of it too is where you're located. So West Side discs flight numbers are notoriously bad because they're testing them in like Sweden or somewhere overseas.
Ah.
So when it gets to here, they fly nothing like that because their flight
number. Do you think they're actually testing them?
I mean,
like,
I would hope so.
Who's testing them?
I don't know.
Who's testing them?
That's the thing. No one knows. But one thing
because
I do know
the thing
is
if you don't have a professional, if you don't have like a really good disc golfer throwing them,
then that might be true.
How are you supposed to know how the disc is going to fly?
Well, you can look at the rim shape and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that for like the speed and stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm saying like testing wise, like to me, the easiest way of doing it is literally having a machine, and you can literally set it at different speeds, different spin rates of how, you know, fast it comes out, and you shoot that thing nose down flat and then base every disc off of that.
Well, yeah, that's how it should be done. But so what's going on right now? Because I wrote a whole article on this for the blog on Foundation's website. And basically, there's different marketing tactics within it, right? Like being the first 100%. Company to come out with a 14-speed disc. When that 14-speed disc is the exact same rim width as Discraft's Nuke, which is a 13-speed.
Yep. And or you can the look opposite. At,
yeah.
Having or a 1-speed.
The Hydrogen Loft putter. It was advertised as like being a 1-speed putter. And they're like, why are we throwing 2-speed putters? It basically means it's a lid. Like, if you look at it, it's like the same type of statistics as the end of a birdie that's been on the market forever. It's just that now it's been remarketed. But the biggest thing to me is every disc has to be sent to the PDGA anyways, right? Mm-hmm. They have to be sent in there for the mold to be approved. There's literally a guy at the PDGA that has every single mold that's ever been approved. So it comes into the PDGA. You just decide your testing process.
Yeah.
You know, whether it is a human or a robot or it's just strictly based on measurement. You got to go robot, but that's a lot more money.
You have millions of dollars in the bank.
That is also true. So we go robot.
You're paying memberships to be a PDGA member. I would think most people would throw $5 or $10 to get a robot. We want robots.
All right, so we get a robot.
We want robots.
So now every mold comes in, you measure the rim width for the speed, whatever you need to for the glide, and then you have the robot throw it, and you have like a visual thing behind him where you can, like, I'm thinking like one of those Mythbusters boards, you know what I mean?
Well, is it?
Where it measures how far it changes off path to the right, and then how far it comes back to the left, and there's your flight numbers. And then you just assign that out.
There'd be no questions
the
about
whole,
it.
And the whole issue
you
of
just
it,
do it at, you do it at, sea level.
Yeah, so the whole issue, or it's not even have to be sea level. If everything's tested in the same thing, the biggest issue is you can't compare across manufacturers right now.
Correct.
That's the biggest issue. So if it's all consistent, it doesn't matter where it was tested. You can at least know.
Well, also, it's not consistent inside a manufacturer.
No.
That's the other thing.
Well, so it all started from...
Say, like, they're this glide, and then you pick a disc that says it's less glide, and you're like, this disc is way glidier than this disc.
So that's a whole different issue within disc golf. That's the inconsistencies between runs because of how long it takes to sit down, all that.
Should different plastics have different flight numbers?
I'm not even talking plastics. I'm saying Star Destroyers used to be notorious for this. It's not as widely popular as it used to be. So not that many people complain about it anymore. But it used to be like Avery Star Destroyers flew different than Paul Star Destroyers, fly different than Ricky Star Destroyers. And then within each of those runs, there's multiple different runs that all fly different. It's a mess. But flight numbers all started from a good point, a good heart, which was Innova created the flight number system so that you could look at their discs and know, I have a rock. I want this disc to be more overstable. Oh, this Gator is a speed faster and it's going to be more overstable. Now I have a T-Bird. Oh, my word, this Thunderbird that just came out, it's like a faster T-Bird. That's the whole point. Made a lot of sense. Back then, no one else was doing flight numbers, really. Discraft had a one flight number system that just told you if the disc was straight, finished it hard, or turned hard, basically was it. But then over time, everyone realized that what Innova's doing makes the most sense. And so everyone adapted it and brought it onto their own discs. But now Discraft was creating the flight numbers for the Discraft discs. Trilogy was creating the flight numbers for Trilogy Disc, Prodigy for Prodigy, and Innova for Innova. So none of them were creating the same flight numbers. Mm-hmm. They all kind of had a base model from Innova, but none of them were creating the exact same. So if flight numbers are going to stick around, which they're not going anywhere because it makes the manufacturers too much money, it needs to come from the PDGA. But within different plastics, some companies are already doing this. I think MVP is one of them that's already putting... Their baseline
there?
Flight numbers will be different than their premium plastic.
Interesting.
I think it's a good idea because the other thing you have to realize is flight numbers are 99% of the time marketed towards newer players trying to figure out what a disc is going to do. So they might not realize that a D-line Buzz is going to fly different than a Z-Buzz.
The crazy thing to me, though, is yes, they are marketed that way, but... They're marketed that way, but they don't like it's to me, it seems like actually backwards because if I was a new player, right, and I didn't throw correctly, a buzz would be really stable.
Yeah.
When in fact, if you look at the numbers, a buzz isn't stable.
It should be dead. Well, it is stable, but dead straight.
It should be straight. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Overstable.
Yeah.
If I'm a new player, that thing's nose up and it's just going left. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so overstable. So to me, it's kind of wild because whenever I'm playing with my local guys and they like, I tell them about the, you know, I'll say, hey, you need to try this disc I have. They're like, oh, what are the flight numbers? And I'm like, stop talking about the flight numbers. I've watched you throw. I know what you need. Pit this disc in your bag and it's perfect for you. So like, that's where it's just like, I think some people get super caught up on flight numbers and they're like, oh my God, this. When in fact, it's like, if you throw 50 miles per hour nose up and someone's throwing 60 miles per hour nose down, the flight numbers at that point are meaningless because the same disc is going to fly completely different.
From that perspective, yes. But where they would still mean something is no matter how you're throwing, a Raptor is still more overstable than an Undertaker.
Yes.
So if I'm throwing nose up, yeah, my Undertaker, it might not have that negative one turn and one fade or whatever it may be, or I think it's two mm-hmm. fade, but I can still know, oh, this is the Undertaker.
Like, what's the next stop?
Negative one, two. Oh, the Raptor's the same first two numbers. Now it's a 0-3. So
this
I
is
know what it's going to do.
This is what I don't understand, though. And maybe I'll never understand. Is, like, I just think there should be categories and leave it at that. Because to me, like, you should basically have, like, your bomber disc. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to throw this a mile. For Discraft's lineup, like, flight numbers don't matter if you literally just say, like, distance driver straight. Like, this is your straight distance driver. And in that category, you would have the crank, the nuke, the Zeus, and maybe that's it. I feel like I'm missing one more. I feel like there's one more in that category. But regardless, you have, like, those three. And then from those three, you're like, okay, these three are basically all the same disc. There's very, very limited, very small differences between those three. All I need to do now is I need to feel them and see how they feel in my hand. And once I find the one that feels good, then I'm gonna throw that one. I think if they did categories like that, it would be interesting to see. Same thing, like, you could go mid-range, again, Discraft lineup, mid-range, understable. You would go Soul, Meteor, Comet, Buzz SS. And it's like, okay, those are my four options. Mm. They're all going to basically fly very similar to one another. Now it's just, let me feel which one feels better. And I'm going to use that one.
Yeah.
I think if they did that and just got rid of flight numbers completely, I think it would be so much easier for the newer disc golfer. But like you said, they make so much money off of flight numbers and marketing stuff and doing all that, that I don't think we'll ever see you get rid of it.
I mean, what you just described is kind of Discraft's original idea. Everything said like buzz, and then it said like super straight mid-range. And then at the bottom, it was a like 0.5. And so they just assigned it one number, which basically described the flight of it. And so a buzz and a wasp would be both like maybe a 0.5 and a 1. So you could see, oh, wow, they're really close to each other. And it just said mid-range on it. So it just gave it one number so that you just saw kind of what it was going to do. But it basically, you could tell the Meteor and the Buzz SS would have both had a negative 0.5. So they would have both been the same disc. And they both would have said mid-range, which is basically what you just described. And so you would have just looked at it and been like, oh, well, I like the feel of the Meteor a little bit more than the Buzz SS. I'm going to try that. Knowing mm-hmm. in your head they're going to fly the same. But, yeah, because, I mean, another great example of why they're never getting rid of flight numbers was the River back in the day. And it's still a little bit like this, but when the River first came out, it had, like, a 6 glide or something like that that we had never seen it before. So I vividly remember me and my brother freaking out because we were newer players, right?
Yeah.
We see the 6 glide, and we're like, this thing's going to stay in the air forever. We have to get this disc.
Yeah.
And what was smart about it was Latitude made a super beginner friendly disc and then assigned that number to it. So the hype was real because like it, all it was a flippy fairway. So when a beginner like us threw it, yeah, it felt like that disc had way more glide
speed forever. Yeah, because you weren't throwing the right disc.
Yeah, because we were throwing, I don't even know what we were throwing. I think my brother was throwing a DX Banshee, which is a really overstable disc, and then just beating it up and hoping it flew good. So what they did is they just took a disc towards beginners, added a crazy high glide, so then when beginners threw it, we would see that glide because the flight would just go so much longer. And then everyone on Reddit was just, it was a never-ending circle of you've got to try the river.
Train.
Yeah, and all it was they just put one more number on the glide, and then it was the first whatever glide disc that the market's ever seen. So that stuff like that is I think we're never getting rid of flight numbers.
I think too, just to kind of wrap this up, I think something too that commentary kind of misses on a little bit is explaining how yes, you do see the top guys throwing destroyers, throwing DD3s, throwing forces, doing you know throwing all these overstable discs, but these discs sometimes have been beaten in so much that they no longer are very overstable. And so when you watch them and they're like, oh my god, they're releasing it on Heiser and they're throwing 500 feet, the thing is when they I got a disc right here, boom, when they release on Heiser, okay, if this is a really overstable disc, this is actually, as soon as I release it on Heiser, it's actually going to start trying to get to the ground and starting to get low and down. And if you're listening, I'm sorry, I'm doing this awesome demonstration. You're missing out. You should have been watching
live. Just close
your
eyes. Well, unless you're driving, don't close your eyes. Yeah, if you're not driving, close your eyes and you can envision it.
But if this disc now is either a flippy disc or I've beaten it in to where it's become flippy, now when I throw it on Heiser, it no longer wants to try to get to the ground. It actually is going to try to get to flat. But because I've thrown it with so much Heiser, it will never get to flat, but it becomes a pushing Heiser. And that's the big difference between there's a difference between a Heiser, a spike Heiser, and a pushing Heiser. A pushing Heiser is one where the disc is continuing to go forward and ever so slightly gets to a little under flat.
It fights the Heiser angle the whole way, but never comes out.
And then just keeps gliding. Yeah. If you watch the best distance throwers, for the most part, that is the disc that is when they're not trying to go max distance, that is the shot you're going to see because they can still throw that shot 500 feet. Mm. And that's the pushing Heiser. And I think that's something that a lot of newer players, including myself, when I first came in, I was like, how the heck are these guys throwing these discs like that? And a lot of it has to do with finding the correct disc. But if your arm speed isn't there, what you have to do is you have to drop down. So if your arm speed isn't there with the nuke, you got to go to the nuke SS. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It's the same thing in golf. Same thing in literally like Hunter, if me and you play tennis, your strings are going to be so loosey goosey. It's going to be insane. You're going to have a trampoline on your tennis racket and mine's going to be a brick. And that's just because I can hit the ball harder than you, man. And
I mean,
it is what it is. It's like you using a wooden bat and I'm using a metal bat. And we're both hitting home runs.
Sorry, we were having a little stream issues. Hopefully it comes through.
I think we're good.
All right.
I think everyone's good. All right.
Sweet.
Can we do let's do some calls.
Let's get some call-ins going here. My internet, I think, just completely dropped out for a second, but we're back. We're back and we're cooking. So
they might have missed all my fantastic analogies.
They didn't miss all of it. They didn't. They missed you roasting me, but I think that was in my favor. So I think we're okay.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, let's get these call-ins.
We got some people in the green room, so we're ready to go.
Let's try Mango. Reb said to try Mango. This is going about as good as we could have ever predicted.
You know, eventually we'll figure out this call-in number.
The call-in number is the way to go. You just got to be up here.
That's the way to go.
You got to be up here.
Well, you know, give me some time, man.
We're like 2 weeks away.
It takes a while.
All right, let's try.
Takes a while.
Let's try Mango. All right, Mango. You're live. Debate Night with Brody and Hunter. Can you hear us? Can we hear you? Let's see.
He unmuted himself. That's a good sign.
Are you alive? Are you there?
Can you guys hear me?
Oh, we got him.
First caller.
There it is. All right. What topic do you have for us?
So the topic I have generally, like, you were on the forcing play by artificially altering the course and the rule set and all of that by the 2 meter rule and the mozzarella sticks and the mandos. And one thing that we as viewers see all the time in all of the broadcast is like, okay, so you got this hole. It's the same hole as last year, but this year we raced the basket to make putts more punishing. It just feels like it's artificially forcing a play that wasn't there. You also have the poor man's OB and the hazard, and you have the drop zones. And for us that are not professionals, they need to be PGGA approved in PGGA sanctioned events. So drop zones. So all of our courses are forcing hazard now because we're not playing pro level courses. And it feels like a lot of tournament designers for pro level play are just increasing the difficulty of the hole by forcing you to get in the circle when you want to make the putt because they raised the basket.
Interesting. Now, Brody, you're a pretty big fan of raised baskets, correct?
I'm a massive fan of raised baskets. I've wanted to do a raised basket challenge for so long. And here's why I'll say I'm a big fan of them is simply because right now there's a situation where putting is too easy. Putting, and what I mean by that is not necessarily like 40 feet, 45, 50 feet, those putts are too easy. The area of where people don't even pay attention to whether or not someone's going to make a putt, I think is too far away from the basket. I would love to see where a 20 footer, there is still some nerves, some pressure, some... where it's not where like everyone at the top is making it every single time. And you kind of look to golf and equate that to golf. Golf is 3 feet. Like once you're inside of 3 feet, you should pretty much make that putt every single time. Once you're at that 3 foot mark, it gets iffy. And especially if you're starting to add in slope and the greens are fast. So to me, when you have that elevated basket, it not only now changes the putt that you practice and do over and over and over again, but it also makes it to where now if you airball your putt, it actually brings in the chance of a potential three putt.
I mean, I get that, but like you saw last tournament, the tournament that Kyle Klein won very recently.
Idlewild,
yeah, where you have one of the first holes where everyone is laying up. Yeah, no, where everyone's laying up because the basket's right down by the OB, by the lake, right?
Are you talking about hole one or are you talking about hole two?
Hole two, yeah.
Not an elevated basket, but yes, continue.
Yeah, it's not elevated, but in terms of making a putt pressure, making a putt difficult, making players want to lay up instead of actually going for the putt and having the risk-reward... Having the OB at the bottom of a slope 10 feet from the basket is a punishing pressure putt. But
yes.
But elevating the basket and removing the OB doesn't create pressure, doesn't create the risk-reward play. So raised basket just feels like you're adding artificial pressure to talk about, but it doesn't really, really... Like a 20-footer, most people are sinking 20-footers at a pretty decent rate, especially at the pro level.
Oh no, for sure. No, I don't think raising the basket solves the 20-footer rule. I think right now, if you're a top disc golf player, you're making pretty much every putt. If it's a basic putt, meaning no trees in the way, you're not having to straddle if you don't like to straddle. If you just have a basic putt, you're gonna see the top players make almost every putt inside of 35 feet. So the question is, do course designs need to go a route to where there are very few times that you have a basic putt? That kind of gets a little bit difficult with some courses. And that's where I think the raised basket, because if you look at the raised basket on hole one at that same tournament, Idlewild, or even hole number four at Idlewild, Those are both raised baskets, and based because there is water or there's a hill next to those baskets as well, it almost forces players to make that decision when they get to probably the 30-foot mark, the 30, 35-foot mark. Now they're thinking about, do I need a layup or should I go for it? Where if it wasn't raised, the 30, 35-foot mark, the most top players are running that every time. So I don't think it solves the problem completely. But I also, the way that the Disc Golf Pro Tour does it as well, I don't think it's terribly gaudy. I don't think it looks bad. I don't think it looks gimmicky with like the nice kind of raised baskets that they have. I think it looks weird if you simply just have a pole that's like 6 feet tall and then a basket. I think that looks weird. But then building out that structure around, I think it looks fine.
Yeah, I was going to pop in too. I think that the raised baskets you've experienced, Brody, are a lot different than the raised baskets we,
correct,
most of the viewers experience. So when you talk raised baskets and you like it, I think that the height that the Pro Tour goes to and the way they raise the basket, I personally like as well, because it's enough to add that secondary, you know, thought process, but it's not so drastic that when you're 5 feet away, you can't tap out. Because I've literally played some holes where you're right under the basket and you're looking up at it like, what the heck is going on here? So I think there's definitely a balance. The Pro Tour seems to have found a nice balance, but when it goes to being artificial and gimmicky, I think if you push it too far, it definitely reaches that level. When you know, I can't exactly even reach into the basket to get my disc out, that's too far.
Yeah, so I think the Pro Tour's height right now is perfect because pretty much everyone can go up and reach it. The baskets that you're talking about, that's where I think you need to have some sort of like tier system or something, to where if you end up missing a putt, it like drops down into where you can actually like just dunk it, versus like you said, you're underneath the basket and it's a super awkward putt from 5 feet. So if you had like a tier system, or you had something where there's like a platform up there, to where I think Belton actually had a couple holes like this that worked really well. But all in all, I see what you're saying, Mango. I think if done correctly and done properly, I don't think it looks bad. And I think it makes disc golf more difficult, which ultimately is probably what the fans want to see.
Yeah. And I mean, another thing, this could also be a topic that goes on forever, but right now you're looking at course designers are like, oh yeah, we merged hole 13 and 14 to make a really long hole, and it's mm-hmm. like it adds difficulty because you need to throw further, but it doesn't make like all of us sitting in the audience like, okay, yeah, we all throw 450 internet distance, don't worry about it.
Well, but I would almost argue that it doesn't necessarily make it harder sometimes, because if you make a hole to the point of where I don't know if you watched D-Glo, but hole 15 at D-Glo is a perfect example. What you're talking about right now, they combined hole 15 and 14 to make a really long par four. And hole 14 originally was a little dinky hyzer par three that you could get birdie, but you could also get par. To get bogey on that hole is nearly impossible. But then hole 15, the original hole 15 was a par four that you could get a three, a four, a five, or a six. So that was like one of the best holes on the course, in my opinion, because of the score separation. When they combine those two holes, yes, did it make it harder in the sense of like, for each person it made it harder? Yes, but like, I don't know how Paul birdied that hole every single day, but that hole wasn't really birdied that much, and there weren't that many high numbers on that hole either, because they took out the bogey, they took out the OB. So what they ended up doing by making the hole longer is they basically made it to where there was going to be less birdies and less scores over par. And so what you end up doing is you just end up making it to where everyone's kind of smack dab in the middle, which is, I don't think, what you want to see. I think you want to see people that play the hole properly and play the hole well get birdies. People that play the hole average get pars. Well get pars. And people that play the hole poorly get bogeys or plus. So I'm with you on that. I'm with you on, hey, we need to make our course harder. what should we do? Let's just make it longer.
Yeah, and again, now we're wrapping back to like, okay, so if we give everyone unlimited airspace to pull all the distance that a pro disc golfer can pull, then you're going to be looking at just like using all of that airspace, and then you've got the 2 meter rule coming back into play. Should they be punished for a tree? And then you're looking at all these artificial rules coming back once again. And it feels really nice just to like watch the back end of the tour where it's like, okay, it's wooded golf, it's tight lines. Like watching mm-hmm. Hanum's ace was something ridiculous. But I hope we have a discussion about wooded golf versus sure. golf course golf. Every single debate night, but I'm not going to be the one pulling you there. I'm just going to let more people get the option to speak.
Hey, we appreciate that, Mingo. Good topics.
Yeah, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll talk to you again later. All right, we got
There was someone chatting up. They had a decent-sized bark, it sounded like, in the chat, but I don't think they're actually going to come on here.
Please do. We want...
They won't.
Spicy takes. It looks like we got a whole bunch of people waiting to get in. I'm going to go ahead and just grab another one. We're going to bring Jake DGF in here. Jake, how's it going? You're live Hello. On Debate Night with Brody and Hunter. What topic do you want to bring up?
Give me 1 second just to turn off the other stream.
Yeah. It's a little delayed.
Okay. So I have a few topics. I'll only pick one just because I'm not sure if you guys have gone over them yet. So please just let me know. So I did want to first talk about the whole, like, kind of mantra that goes around, especially, like, in amateur disc golf of drive for show, putt for dough. I don't think that's actually the case. I think it's the opposite. I think driving is way more important in disc golf, and I would like to discuss that.
Yeah, with how easy putting is, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the whole thing I was making, is, right, kind of what you guys were talking about earlier is how putting in golf is a lot harder than disc golf, right?
I think
driving in golf is a lot harder than disc golf. Everything in golf is harder than disc golf.
Yeah.
There's literally not an there's nothing that you can tell me that is easier in golf than disc golf. There isn't. And so I think that is that at the end of the day is one of the reasons why I think more OBs should be implemented. And obviously it's a different game and such, but I think because putting is easier, because driving is easier, I think you can set up courses in a way that make it to where players that are playing well will always kind of rise to the top, if that makes sense.
I will say the drive for show, putt for dough thing, I think is true for lower level amateurs. When you're just getting into the sport, you're going to win a lot more tournaments on the amateur level if you're a really good putter. Driving, I don't think, starts to matter until you're a decent putter. And so as you get farther up, when you're a pro, yeah, if you can't throw 450, it doesn't matter if you're banging every 30-foot putt because you're never going to get there for birdie. But correct. When you're on the lower level of the sport, I mean,
every hole's birdie ball.
Yeah, pretty much any win I've ever had was just because I had a good putting day, not because my drives were on.
And I think you see a lot more people, too, at the amateur level that just really struggle with putting. Like, if you three-putt... I can almost count the number of times I've three-putted on tour, and I wouldn't even consider myself a good putter compared to some of the top guys. But if you go to any sort of C-tier, B-tier event and you watch someone's round, you're probably going to see some three-putts, which would be, you know, very, very rare on the pro tour.
That's definitely interesting. How I've kind of looked at it is, like, there's a lot more that can go wrong off the tee. You can get a lot mm-hmm. more strokes off the tee rather than on the green. Like, the worst that can happen usually on the green is that you three-putt. But off the tee, you can go a B, right?
Well, I think it also kind of... It's a different skill thing, right? Like Hunter was saying, if you're on the pro tour talking about what's more important, that's going to be completely different than if you're an MA3 player. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing as if you're an MA3 player and an MA1 player. Those things are completely different. Because what you're saying is, like, you know, there's a lot more things that can go wrong off the tee. But as your skill level goes up and up and up, like, you're expected to hit that 20-foot gap that's 30 feet off the tee pad, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're expected to be able to do all these things, where at the lower levels,
maybe not so much.
No, I definitely see what you're saying. So then, how exactly do we make, like, holes on the Pro Tour? Like, how do we make them, like, as you were saying, like, kind of hard to the point, but still fair? Because what I hate are, like, hard holes that are, like, like dice rolling. Like, there's a hole in my course where the gap, there's a bunch of trees, tiny little gaps to the point where it's just not fair. So you're just throwing and just hoping and praying. It's not a fair gap.
Well, there's a reason why it's called the fair way, right? And I think it makes even more sense in disc golf than it does in golf, calling it the fairway. But to me, if you're going to have a fairway, and if we're talking about woods golf right now, you got to have it to where if you hit the fairway, if you hit in the gap, there shouldn't be other trees in the fairway that you need to miss.
Right.
There should
be rewarded for hitting the fairway.
There's a hole very similar to probably one that you're talking about where it's a very tight gap. It's like 375 feet and it's a tunnel, basically a tunnel, no more than maybe 20 feet all the way down. And there's two random trees that are just sitting in the middle of the fairway about 150 feet off the tee. And it's one of those things where you throw the perfect shot and it's like the nice hyzer flip and you're like, yes, yes, yes. And now you're just hoping it doesn't hit one of those two trees in the fairway. I'm with you on that. I think, again, I'm going to look at what golf does. Golf basically makes it to where there's a fairway, there's a first cut, and a second cut. The fairway is going to give you the best lie. The first cut's going to be a little bit worse. And then the second cut, you're going to be in trouble to like be able to hit your next shot. So in disc golf, because they don't really have a way, especially if we're playing like in an open setting. So look at like Preserve, for example, right? It's very difficult to like have something in to obstruct you throwing, right?
Yeah.
In golf, all you need to do is make the grass 1 inch longer, and now it's way harder to hit that ball than it is in the fairway. If the grass is a foot longer where you're throwing your disc, it's not going to change much of anything. So I think that is where you have to use hazards and you have to use OB. And so I would go, if you're watching at home, I would go fairway and then outside, maybe like 30 feet on either side, hazard. And then anything outside of that is OB and it's stroke and distance. And now that basically makes it to where good shots don't get penalized at all. Bad shots get penalized and very bad shots get extremely penalized. And now all of a sudden you're going to see people that are throwing well, scoring well, people that aren't throwing well, not scoring well. That's what I would do. Hunter, do you have anything?
Yeah, I think kind of going on what you're saying is one of my biggest pet peeves in disc golf right now is a lot of times good shots are punished just as much as mediocre shots. Yes. And so I think good course design, a good shot will always be rewarded, and then a bad shot will always be punished. Maybe there's always going to be lucky breaks that change those things a little bit, but when out of your hand, you hit the line, you do exactly what you asked it to do, there's not going to be some sneaky branch, sneaky root, sneaky tree that's going to kick you off the fairway. I think focusing on courses that do stuff like that to where it's a dedicated line, it allows, even if it's like a 1,000-foot par five, it allows if you're throwing in the fairway, you're going to be able to get there and do what you want. And then if you mess up, you're going to struggle. That, to me, creates really good score separation to where you can start seeing those holes that provide everywhere from a 2 to a 5. So when we're coming down the stretch and it's hole 16 and there's a 2-stroke lead, it doesn't feel like it's over anymore. Now it feels like, hey...
Yes.
All of it, like if Ricky messes this up, if he pulls it a little bit, it the game's back on. Whereas a lot of times in disc golf right now, it's like if you have a 3-stroke lead with 2 to play, there's almost nothing. If you're a top player in the world, there's almost nothing
you
that
can
just happen.
Par out.
Yeah, that
very
makes
few
you lose it.
Very few course setups. Very few course setups do they make it to where something crazy can happen. And to button this one up, we've all played holes where like the desired shot is the skip shot, right? You throw it 300 feet and you're trying to get it to land on a little bit of a hyzer so it skips to the basket for whatever reason. If you know that is how the hole is set up, bad design, in my opinion, is to not have that area, that 50 feet, 100 feet, whatever it is, that area where everyone's trying to throw and skip, to not have that surface be the same. Because the goal should be to get your disc to land there with the correct angle. The goal should not be to get your disc to land there and then cross your fingers that it doesn't hit a rock and it doesn't hit a root. So that, I think, is just kind of one of the ways of eliminating that luck factor, because the skill is to get your disc to the spot. The skill is to get the disc to the spot with the right speed, and the skill is to get the disc to the spot with the correct angle. Now you're just adding in a luck factor when you have obstacles and stuff that it's just hit or miss whether or not you're going to hit it. That's what I'll say with that.
And I'll add on one last thing before I finish up. So, like, adding on to that, it's like, I don't, to make the hole fair, I hate, like, when, you know, it's right, some courses need to be made harder because they're too outdated, but I don't like when course designers make artificial OB that doesn't really make any sense. Like, for example, there are a few holes at, like, a local B tier where, like, there are just these random rivers, like tiny little rivers throughout the hole, and it was just basically luck whether you landed there or not.
Yeah,
right?
Those are bad.
Yeah, so it should be a defined fairway. I mean, and if you're going to add OB, it should be off that fairway.
I mean, for the most part, all OB is for the most part artificial.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, the way that most courses are probably going to be set up is where it's like off the property. Right. That's the whole reason why it's called out of bounds, is because in golf, they literally had like, this is our property. If you hit the ball out of our property, we can't allow you to hit from there. So that's out of bounds. That's how it came about. And so, but I think in golf, you are seeing not all OB on the property line, right? They do push OB in a lot of areas. And so I think, especially in disc golf, you're going to have to do that because, like we just said earlier, it's way easier to throw a disc and get it to go where you want than it is to hit a golf ball. And so,
yeah,
we can't be having the same, like the same, and this is mostly talking about open courses. You don't want to have an open course where it's like, hey, if you land anywhere inside this 100 yards or whatever it may be, you're safe. I think that's where it's like you got to tighten it in. And a perfect example, hole 18 at the fort at Worlds, right?
Yeah.
How exciting was that hole? And that was all artificial OB. That was all calculated of, hey, we want this thing to get tight and we want it to turn and then we will open it up around the green. That is what a well-designed hole looks like. And it created the most drama in disc golf in probably the last 10 years.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that hole is a perfect example of where, I guess my definition of artificial OB shouldn't be just, you know, just OB. I think artificial OB, how I'm using it, is like unfair gotcha OB.
Yes.
Where it's just, yeah, it's like, haha, you landed 1 inch too short, gotcha, even though you threw a good shot.
Well, I think that's just back to good course design versus bad course design.
Yes.
A good course designer is going to leave those random trees that you throw a good shot and it slaps you down, or a bad course designer is going to do that, and a bad course designer is going to put OB that is just unlucky if you land in it or not. A good course designer is going to think through and be intentional with where the OB is, what trees they're leaving, what trees they're taking out, and that's going to result all around. I think it can all be beneficial for the sport, regardless of artificial OB or natural OB.
Every pro level course should have some sort of artificial OB on it, because with the land and the stuff that we're able to have currently, there isn't a course that I've seen on tour where you weren't able to have artificial OB. So I think the pro tour is getting a lot better at setting up courses too. And so I think you'll just continue to kind of see that kind of, again, I don't think anyone has problems with artificial OB when, like you said, it's not that gotcha. Like hole 17 at Idlewild, no one likes that hole because you're throwing a disc through a bunch of trees and there's OB randomly, sprayed through the hole. So that hole does feel like, hey, I'm going to throw and then I'm just going to hope for the best. And I don't think people at home really want to watch that kind of style.
But thank you.
Jake, yeah, thank you for coming on. Thank Appreciate you. It. Hunter, we can maybe grab two more quick people.
Yeah, there's one, Jet. He actually changed his name in Discord, which is funny, to Jet 2 Meter Debate.
Oh,
I saw him in the chat.
Jet 2 Meter Debate. You got to bring Jet in.
He wants to talk about the 2 Meter. I saw him in the chat, so let's bring him on here and see what he's about to say.
That is smart. If you're trying to catch our attention, changing your name in Discord, that is smart.
All right, Jet, welcome to the show. I've heard that you have some things to say about the 2 meter rule, and I am itching to hear your side of things. So go ahead and let us hear it.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I'm going to play devil's advocate really, really hard for the 2 meter rule.
Where are you from?
I'm from South Dakota.
We keep forgetting to ask people where they're from.
Yeah, we need to be doing that.
Yeah, we need to ask. Okay, South Dakota. Okay.
And I
thought you were going to say California there for a second.
No. But I do also want to say I think we should do this from a frame of like a professional pro tour level, mm-hmm. because the courses I'm playing where there are a lot of bad course designs, I think is irrelevant when talking about the courses you're playing, where you're playing elite pro level courses that should be maintained and designed properly. So I'm really against the 2 meter rule a while ago, and you were just talking about it, and I was thinking about it, where I think Hunter even said something like, me and you can both throw a really good shot, and one of us will get stuck in the tree, and one of us won't. And I think Hunter used the word the same shot, which in reality, it's not the same shot. Much Correct. Like if you threw it into a tree, and Hunter threw it 1 inch to the left, and he kicked straight left into the OB, whereas you kicked right and fell straight down when you used to be in bounds. Like, the shot was just inch different, but one was a quote-unquote okay shot, and one was a bad shot. They weren't the exact same shot.
Well, I don't know if you could consider, because your scenario right there that you just said, where if you have one disc hit an inch to one side of a tree versus the other, one drops and one goes to the left. If that tree was off the target line, right? Like, you shanked your shot, then it is what it is. Like, you threw a bad shot and one person threw a bad shot and got a bad result. One person threw a bad shot and got lucky. The problem with that is when that tree is in the middle of the fairway, like 300 feet down the fairway. Both people in that scenario threw a good shot because they hit the fairway, right? And then one got extremely unlucky and one got lucky. So that's where, in the first scenario that I gave you, both threw bad shots. One deserved what they got. The other one got lucky. This scenario, one person got lucky and one person got unlucky. I think it's the same probably thing with the 2 meter rule, of where you're going to have situations where the correct shot is to throw a big hyzer into a tree and hopefully it plinkos down. And if two people did that and one person just gets stuck up there, that's unlucky. And then there's going to be other scenarios where you shank your shot into a tree and one person gets stuck up there and one person doesn't. And in that scenario, you have someone getting lucky and the other person, I wouldn't consider it unlucky that stayed up there. You shanked your shot. So that's why I just don't like the rule in general, because I don't know, man. It's just like, I don't like it when you're adding in luck factor. That's what I don't like. Well, I like taking the luck factor as much out of disc golf as possible.
This was also just mentioned in the comments, but I think it's a great point, so I'm now going to steal it as my own. Sorry.
Absolutely. That's
sorry,
what we do here.
Sorry, 50 stitches steal. He said, so imagine we both threw the exact same shot, right? But during mine, it's windy. So mine, the branches are moving. I hit the tree. It should stick in the tree. The wind shakes it, falls down. Brody's hits the tree. It's not windy. Point. Sticks in the tree. We threw the same shot. We hit the same branch. Now the wind made mine fall down, made his stay up. There's so much, I think, when you add a tree in that it just falls to luck. Like, whether or not a disc falls out of a tree, we've all played courses where we've hit the same tree over and over, and sometimes they fall, sometimes they don't. I don't like the idea of whether or not it fell out of the tree, which is completely out of my control, being what penalizes me or not.
Jet,
yeah,
question for you. Go should disc golf Should disc golf adopt the golf rule in this scenario and say, hey, your disc got stuck in the tree? You have two options. You play it as an unplayable and you take a stroke, or you go up in the tree and you throw it from where your disc is. That's not electric. Seeing people climb a tree
I could see Matt Bell scaling that tree and throwing from the top of it. But I also I do have a few questions for you. You mentioned the throw the hyzer into the tree, one falls down, one's essentially parked, and one doesn't, and they're stuck in the tree and they're penalized for it. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that's probably bad course design? So let's just say, because the one course on tour where this is relevant is De La Vega.
Yep.
And I think Hunter and on Grip Lock, they talk about how just outdated De La is for many reasons, let alone just the 2 meter rule. Even if you take out the 2 meter rule on that course, it's still outdated and it probably shouldn't be on the pro tour. But question for you, when you're playing your practice rounds on these manufactured, really nice, clean course, how many times during a practice round are you actually getting stuck in a tree?
That's a good question. I don't know if a disc of mine has gotten stuck in tournaments, but I will say I probably have gotten maybe three to five stuck in a tree throughout all my practice rounds and all my practice shots, I would say, throughout the season so far.
And this is this year, correct?
Correct, yeah.
So you throw, and I know obviously some practice rounds are different. Sometimes you only throw one. Sometimes you might throw four or five.
No, I throw a lot of shots up until the final round.
So even better. You throw a ton of shots on every hole, and you play, what, four or five practice rounds?
Probably four on average.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's right around there. So you're throwing hundreds and hundreds of shots, mm-hmm. and you're not getting stuck in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Is that probably safe to say because you're at least attempting the line that the hole is asking for and you're executing it at a high level?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's the argument. I think my argument against the 2 meter rule isn't so much that it's a rarity or that it only affects bad shots. I think that is my argument of where right now you have a situation where two people throw bad shots and one person can get double penalized. That's what I don't like.
So what if we raised it? Because the 2 meter rule is actually pretty low. I mean, like
6 feet.
Right. A disc could be small. Like you could be looking at your disc eye to eye and it'd be 2 meter rule. Like you're taller than the 2 meter rule.
Yeah, I'm a beast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what if we raised it to like 3 meters, which is almost 10 feet. Whereas like you're probably not to throw it that high.
No one is, that's the thing. When your disc gets stuck in a tree, you weren't trying to, and this is again, talking about courses that you're not throwing, you know, these Plinko shots, right? Where you're just chucking into trees and hoping for the best. When your disc gets stuck in the tree, that you threw a bad shot. That is not my argument. You threw a bad shot. No one's trying to throw that. So whether you threw it high, to the left, to the right, you threw a bad shot. My argument is, two people could throw bad shots in the scenario of hitting the tree and one person gets penalized and one person doesn't. It's similar to OB, for example. If I throw 1 foot OB and you throw 450 feet OB, we both are penalized the same. We both threw bad shots and we both are penalized the same. I think that is where it is where someone in that scenario is getting double penalized and someone's only getting somewhat penalized by hitting a tree.
So is it any different than, say, if we both airball a putt by 30 feet and yours catches a rock and rolls down the hill into the water, whereas mine just decides to sit there? Is it any different? Like,
no, I don't think it's any different, actually. I think trying to minimize that, but I would say...
I think the difference is...
Yeah, Hunter, come in and save me.
Well, I'm going to say, I think the difference in that scenario is they're both obviously basically resulting in the same thing. We both threw the same shot, but one's controllable. One's the TD's decision, and one's just bad luck. So I think, why should we have the TD decision be the one penalizing us when the other...
Yeah, in this scenario, it'd almost be like Jet. It'd almost be like the TD being like, hey, we are going to put roll-away ramps in for today's tournament. And what that basically means, since no one has ever heard the term roll-away ramps, if you miss a putt and your putt hits this ramp, it will roll every time. To me, that's you're now adding more luck.
Right,
or like bad luck.
We should be moving luck. We should be getting luck out of it as much as possible.
I do want to say, I think it is absurd that we have a rule that is only played in one state of the country. I think that's
They love it. When I played a tournament over there, they literally, in all caps, at the very end of the rule said, and we will be playing the 2 meter rule! Exclamation point, smiley face.
People fight hard for it.
I was like, that's how you know that they're all about it. Because they know people hate it, but they love it.
And I do want to say, I think that is absurd. Just for the simple fact that, especially on the Pro Tour, like, you should not go to one Elite Series event and play with different rules than the next. But that's beside the point. But I know you talk a lot about score separation.
Yes.
So you talked about how we both throw bad shots. So it's clear we both throw bad shots. You get stuck in the tree, but mine falls down.
Mm-hmm.
But if none of us get penalized worse than the other, granted it may be quote-unquote lucky, you probably shouldn't have thrown that bad shot in the first place.
Yep.
So at that point, we're just allowing for more score separation, or we're not allowing for more score separation by the fact that we both, through one of us, unfortunately, got a little bit luckier than the other. And that's just, I mean, that's the way disc golf is. And so many things is that quote-unquote luck-based. There's less score separation if we take away rules like that, because I'm part of disc golf is being lucky. I mean, if there was no luck, Paul Macbeth might win every single week. That's just the reality of the situation.
I would disagree with that, but no, there is. I mean, every sport there's luck, right? I mean, every sport there is some form of luck, but There's a reason why like slots isn't a sport that people watch. As far as I'm concerned, there's no professional slots. There's no professional Game of War, the card game. There's no professional Crazy Eights or these. And what I'm trying to get at is these are all things where luck is bigger than skill. When luck becomes more important than the skill, it's not enjoyable as a fan to watch. And I think that's where, I mean, look at fighting, right? Some could say fighting, there's a lot of luck involved, because if you get caught with one punch on the right spot, you can go down. And that's where they say, you know, everyone's got a fighter's chance. Everyone's got that one punch chance to knock someone out. Like, I technically have a chance of beating Floyd Mayweather, right? If I catch him with the right punch, I could potentially beat Floyd Mayweather. But the amount of skill involved in fighting versus the luck outweighs it drastically. And I think that's where, if you can take, I don't think you want to insert the luck. That's where I think it is.
Yeah.
I think every sport has some luck already just in it with how it is. I don't think you want to do anything that inserts luck. And I think that's what the 2 meter rule does, is it's inserting luck. Because think about this, right? Me and you both throw a terrible shot into a tree, correct?
Yep.
Yours hits the tree and drops. Mine goes straight through and gives me a circle one putt. That's luck. And there's nothing the tournament director, there's nothing anyone in disc golf could do to take that away. It's going to happen. And so there's already luck implemented. Same thing like you said, two putts, same exact putt, one decides the roll, one decides the not. I think when a TD inserts themselves to put in a rule that is going to make it to where now their luck is more involved, I think that's the problem. It's Hunter, like, you have anything else to say on this one?
Yeah, to expand on that, it's like the same thing we were just talking about like the artificial OB, where bad artificial OB is ones where it's like just kind of thrown in there where you might land in it, you might not. It's lucky. I think it's the same style thing here, where that's just bad course design. If you're throwing the 2 meter rule in and forcing luck upon players when luck probably shouldn't be there, because realistically the luck is, do you stay in the tree or do you fall out? Like, because you might punch through the tree, get to the basket, and I might hit up in the tree and stick there. So now imagine, like, if we're playing a 2 meter rule, Brody hits the same tree, fights through all the branches, gets to the basket that's 60 feet away, and I stay up. Now I'm double penalized. Not only am I 60 feet farther back, but now I also have a stroke. That's bad luck, but now I'm penalized for my bad luck that I already had. And I think that's where people in the chat were kind of confusing it. We shouldn't eliminate all luck from disc golf, but we should eliminate forcing luck in disc golf.
Well, you can't eliminate all luck.
No, because the rollaways are going to happen.
Impossible.
But we shouldn't force luck. There's no way just like we shouldn't be adding, like, this legitimately happened a few years ago at a major, an AM major I was playing, and there were tires in the middle of the fairway that was like the designated landing zone where they wanted you to land. And so if you landed in the tires, you had to do like a football run-up thing. That's just awful course design, because if I land short of the tires, I have a great run-up.
That's kind of hilarious, though.
If I land in it, it's super gimmicky. It's forced luck, right? That type of stuff is just awful.
Quick question, probably before I get off here, because I know there's other people waiting. So I have, obviously we talked about bad shots, but I think now, especially when you look at, and probably like hole 9 at Idlewild, I think it's hole 9. Is that the one Chris Dickerson aced?
Yes.
Yeah, the little turnover. Shot.
Yep. Yeah. The turnover shot, but you have Kevin Jones, Eagle McMahon, throwing it 150 feet up in the air, and they would love to get stuck in a tree. Absolutely love it, because they're literally going to be right next to the basket, stuck in the tree 15 feet up in the sky, whereas Chris Dickerson is throwing this touchy shot through the woods, through the fairway, and if he misses the basket or the trees, he's 50 feet past the basket.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if the 2 meters in effect,
what's the you're thinking those guys aren't throwing that grenade shot when the 2 meter rule's in effect?
Heck no.
Well, I think this.
You're telling me Kevin Jones couldn't throw a touchy putter shot through the trees?
Well, this is what I'll say. I think I actually messaged this to our group chat where I said, because we were all watching that Delaware for whatever reason. We were not about Delaware. I watched like the last 7 holes, and that was pretty much it. But we were all watching Idlewild. I think, Hunter, I texted the chat that Kevin was losing strokes by throwing so many grenades. Like, there were plenty of holes where he was throwing a grenade where I was like, what? Like, why? Like, his backhand putter game is so good. Like, why is he throwing a grenade here?
Yeah.
So I think it comes and goes, man. Like, in that scenario, I'm fine if I'm competing against someone one-on-one and they just want to keep tossing crazy grenades like that when it's not the best throw. I think that's fine. I think when you break a hole with a grenade or an over the top or something like that, that's where it gets a little bit dicey for me.
But that's where the course designer should just adjust the tee or
put some type of
Mando in that you have to go under. Because a Mando... Yeah. 25 feet in the air doesn't affect anyone's shot except for the up and over, and it forces everyone to go down the middle. I think that's a better solution than a 2 meter rule.
Jet, this is what I'll say. I never saw Kevin throw a grenade during that tournament where I was like, shoot, I need to go and learn how to throw a grenade because he made that hole way easier. Like, in my opinion, he has an extremely good grenade. He's very accurate with it, but I don't think he threw it. There wasn't a moment that he threw it to where I was like, that is the best throw in that scenario. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I can agree with that. But I think as time goes on, like, it shouldn't be a thought where in practice rounds, players get to the tee, people like Eagle McMahon and Kevin Jones, like, the first thing they do is look up in the sky to see if they can just throw it over the trees. And even if you made a small tweak where you raised the meter, so it's maybe 3 or 4, where if you're 10... 12 feet up in the air, stuck in the tree, like you must have thrown a really bad shot, really, really bad shot, or you were trying to throw it that high, and like you're essentially kind of trying to break the hole, if you will, and then you didn't successfully break the hole. So I should think you get punished, for that if you're up, you know, 15 feet in the sky. But 2 meters, I think, is pretty low, and I can't understand where if you both threw equally quote-unquote bad shots that mm-hmm. one shouldn't get double stroked. But I think that might it makes score separation it would separate scores more, whether that's good or bad. That's up to you, but I appreciate you guys having me on. I know there's more people waiting. So
hey, thanks nice for changing your name, dude. I think you're gonna be a trendsetter with the change in your name. That was a baller move.
I appreciate it, guys. Have a good
thanks
night.
For coming on, brother.
Well, sweet. I felt like that was a pretty good back and forth. He did bring up a few good points, but he didn't sway me.
Almost got me. He almost got me with the two putts.
Yeah.
And you came in and saved me.
Yeah, I was anti.
Stumped. I was stumped. I was like, oh, yeah, you're actually right. And then you came in and you're like, well, to be
one's
fair.
One's a decision, one's not.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, my God, Hunter just destroyed me. Wow. Debate night at its full force right there. I think that's a good stopping point, honestly. I mean, I'm pretty happy with how these calls went.
Yeah, I think it was very well.
Some people brought some heat, which is nice. I mean, again, there's going to be a lot of keyboard warriors in the chat that they can't stand up and get into the kitchen where the fire is. You know, they just want to type behind their keyboard. Maybe they don't have a mic. Maybe they don't own an iPhone. I don't know. I don't know what the reasoning is, but there will be more and more keyboard warriors, and you know what? That's fine.
I'm just excited for the day that one of them actually calls.
Oh, I cannot wait.
That's just going to be fun.
I'll be licking my chops.
I'll be sitting back here with popcorn watching you two do your thing.
Make sure you guys that are watching right now and listening, make sure you guys do go over to our new Twitter. It is at Debate Night Pod. And then also make sure you guys check out us on Apple Podcasts. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts right now, drop us a rating, drop us a review. Oh, I didn't even read our review. I'll save it to the end.
This one
is another one. Well, not another one, but this is another time where if you're not driving, close your eyes real quick for me. Okay. Everyone just close your eyes and visualize this. This comes from the user Understatement. He says, "This podcast is a true masterpiece. It is like watching a summer storm roll in from the comfort of my own front porch. There is some excitement, noise, and energy coming from Brody that is like flashes of lightning and rumbling thunder that pairs perfectly with the consistent, calming rainstorm in Hunter on the other side of the screen. I don't think I would want to be in the thick of the disc golf debates myself, but I'm happy watching from afar. This show is best served live, and it probably needs a different name." Now, I think the last part, first off,
that was
this guy, we might need to hire this guy to write for us.
He's a poet. I mean, didn't even know it.
That brought tears to my eye. But the last part, because I read this to Kelsey, and she's like, different name? What the heck? And I was like, that's the only thing you pulled from this? I think that's because we went live at like 12 o'clock.
Yeah. Debate middle of the day.
Yeah. So they were like, what the heck?
This is hopefully the new night. Tuesday night.
I don't know if it's late enough though. Is six Eastern late enough? I still feel like people are trying to get off work.
Well, this normally would be later, but you wanted to grind out some Apex Legends.
That is true. I'm thinking like potentially like I'm thinking maybe I stream early on Tuesdays, and then that way we can go like at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah.
Tuesday night, debate night.
I'm feeling that.
And go that way.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see.
But Tuesday seems to be the home. I like the Tuesday. I think it fits great in our lineup of podcasts and videos that we already got going on. And I think that hopefully people who are listening live, that also allows us to release it Wednesday morning on the audio podcast platforms. I think that fits well into everything else we have going on.
Heck yeah. No, this went great. And again, I just encourage you guys to watch live, jump into the live calls, and let's debate, baby.
Let's do it. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll talk to you all next week.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Imagine.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Walmart has Straight Talk Wireless, so I can keep doing me. Like hitting up all my friends for a last-minute study sesh. Or curating the best pop playlist you've ever heard in your life. And even editing all my socials to keep up with what's new. Oh yeah, I look good. Post it. Which all in all suits my study poppy main character vibes to a T. Period. Find and shop your fave tech at Walmart.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.